A couple of reminders in case you need them. One is that if you're going to turn your DCF for feedback, not for a grade, it's optional. You don't have to do it. Try to get it done by this Friday, but it's not a drop dead. So if it's not done by Friday, if you get it done by Saturday, sometime in the near future. I don't want to do continue through May 8th or something. So you know, if you can get it done by Friday, that'd be great because it'll give me at least the weekend to work on. I've had about 15 already turned in over the weekend. I think I've returned most of them. So there are a few that came in this morning I haven't had a chance to look at. So I try to get them back almost immediately. So if you send it and you get it back in 5 minutes, it's not because I didn't take a look at it. I took a look at it and I'll give you what I think might need to be tweaked. Right? The other is, and I know you don't want to hear this, but there's no rest for the wicked. If you check your calendar, no, it's coming a week from today. It's quiz two, right? And quiz two is going to cover the mechanics of DCF, right? We stop quiz one, I think, in cash flows. This will cover growth rates and terminal value and the loose ends, cross holdings, cash, employee compensation, all those little things that can get you into trouble. So that's quiz two. It's a week from today. I'll send you a link to the webcast to watch the past quizzes. So you'll have, you know, so there'll be two things you're working on. If you're doing the valuation still, you're saying one more thing. I'm sorry, I know they all pile up, but that's the way it is. The second half of the semester, things just pile up. Okay. So today I want to talk more about the mechanics. I said, we're now going to be talking about valuations, but rather than spend all my time on valuing one company, what I'll do is I'll value a bunch of companies. With each one, I'll focus on something different. So at the start of the class test today, I'm going to focus on a couple of mechanics. And this is very relevant to your project. So you valued a company, you come up with the value per share. First thing you check is the price per share. And if your value is very different from the price, part of you is freaking out, right? But let's say you do get a value that is very different from the price. I'll list out potential explanations and you tell me which of these is the best explanation for your value is different from the price. The first is that you're right and the market is wrong. That requires a very special type of ego, but if you have it, I am an op. So if that's where you're going to go, okay. The other is you're wrong and the market is right. Which actually, if it's the first or second or third time you valued a company, is where you're going to start. You're going to start with a presumption that you must have missed something. It's human nature. Don't fight it. It's the nature of learning how to deal with valuation. Just live with it. Say, well, okay, what am I going to do about the fact that I feel uncomfortable about the fact? The third is that you're both wrong. Yeah. That's, I think, the right answer. The question is, who's wronger, right? You don't have to be right to make money. You just have to be less wrong than everybody else. I think that's the healthiest place to be, right? Because if you think you're wrong and the market is right, you will reverse engineer to get a value close to the price. And some of you, I can already see it happening. One valuation was within 3 cents of the actual value. You either got those coincidences with you, or you tweak the numbers till you got to close enough that you felt comfortable. Okay. Again, don't fight it. If that's what you're going to be doing, that is it, no, recognize that that's what you're doing. You obviously can't both be right. That'll be a very strange process. And none of the above, I don't even know how you can have none of the above, because I don't think there is a fifth option that's not already covered. So their Venn diagram, I've covered pretty much every possible outcome. What I'm trying to say in a long-winded way is, when you come up with a value different from the price, don't make it the center of your universe. Kind of deal with the fact that you're uncomfortable. Ask yourself, is there something obvious I've missed? An extra zero, that can make a difference. An input that you entered incorrectly. But ultimately, it's not, and I said that little table on Friday, think of that as your tweak. Did you get this in the email where I said, look, if your value is wrong, I'll tell you how you can increase your value. It's not coming from the spreadsheet. Here are the things that will increase your value. Here are the things that will decrease your value. Play with them if you're feeling uncomfortable. Increase your revenue growth. That'll increase most of the time your value, but sometimes it can reduce your value if your reinvestment is really high. Increasing the margins will always increase value. Increasing the sales to capital ratio will always increase value. Why? Because you're reinvesting less for the same growth rate. So if nothing else, get comfortable with moving those variables around and see what it does to your value. Today, we're actually going to get a chance to value young companies. The company I'm going to value is no longer young. It's Amazon, but the valuation I'm going to do is of January 2000. So peak of the dot-com boom, Amazon is a small money-losing company. So I'm going to ask you a question, which you're going to run into in valuation, but sometimes it happens under the surface. You don't even realize you're dealing with it. Let's say you're valuing a company. You're doing an equity valuation. You take cash flows to equity, and you discount them back today using your cost of equity to come up with a value of equity of 100 million. This company has 10 million shares outstanding. But based on the fact that you have negative cash flows early on, you estimate you will have to issue more shares in the future. So it's not a problem, it's a feature of the company. And you expect that you will have to issue 2.5 million more shares in the future to cover your negative cash flows. So I have a very simple mechanical question. You come up with a value of equity of 100 million. To get the value per share, which share count should I use? The 10 million that you have right now, the 12.5 million you will expect to have with the shares issued, because that'll give you very different answers, or maybe is an answer in the middle. What do you think? The 100 million is the value of the equity, but the question is, will you use 10 million in the denominator? You use 10 million. So let me play devil's advocate. You're telling me you're going to be issuing the shares. Why aren't you counting the shares you tell me you'll be issuing in the future? Don't say Mike, did you? You have, right? You did the DCF. You had negative cash flows up front. So when you did the present value, and this is one of the magical things in DCF, so it's an amazing thing that happens. When you do the present value, you've lowered the present value already because you have negative cash flows in years 1, 2, and 3. In effect, you've dealt with the dilution that's going to happen in your present value. If you now proceed to divide that value by 12.5 million shares, you're actually double counting. You've reduced the present value by the negative cash flows, and then you're counting the number of shares you will have to issue to cover those cash flows. You think, but why do equity research analysts do it? Because they don't do DCFs. If you're doing an earnings per share based on net income 10 years from now, and you're going to apply a PE ratio to it, of course you should be counting shares you will issue in the future because you're not counting in the negative cash flows. Think of how much pain this is going to take away from the process, because if you could not do this, you will now have to estimate how many shares you will need to issue in year one to cover your cash flows in year one, which means you have to estimate the price at which you'll be in this chicken and egg problem, which is how do you get to a value per share? Because you'll have to estimate future prices per share to get to the value today. So when you value young companies, the dilution is already embedded in your present value. There's nothing to worry about. It's not that you don't realize there'll be dilution, but it's already been factored into the value per share. So when I do the Amazon valuation, I'll tell you exactly how much of a discount I'm applying to the value for expected share count. But that's why we can afford to ignore it. So let's move back to the notes. I think I left you with a question about target prices. You remember that? I said, if any of you end up a sell-side equity research analyst, one of the things you will find is in sell-side equity research, you don't actually give a value today. Assuming you do valuation, you give a target price. So you give the price today and the target price, and the entire basis of your buy recommendation is based on the target price. When you do a DCF valuation, though, what you get is the value per share today. So I want to talk a little bit about the mechanics of how you convert a value per share today into a target price. So let's go back to the Con Ed example. Remember the value per share that I got was $40.76, and the current price is $42.30. I want you to give me a target price per share for this company and what it will mean if I go out and buy the stock today. So let's start with the first one. You've got the price today. You got a cost of equity of 7.7%. And the dividends that are going to be paid next year is going to be about $2.36. I'm going to argue with those three numbers, the price today, the cost of equity, and the additional component of dividends. You should be able to tell me what the price will be 1 year from now. How does knowing the cost of equity, the price today, and the dividends next year allow you to compute the cost of equity, the expected price a year from now? First, let's start with the price today. Go. Yeah.
I think
so the cost of equity was this fancy word, but basically if the stock is correctly priced, what should it do? It should deliver a return of 7.7%, a total return. So if I take the $42.30 and grow it at 7.7%, if there were no dividends, that's what the price will be 1 year from now. But since I'm getting $2.36 of that as dividends, I'm going to subtract out the dividend because the price appreciation only is that portion that's not dividends. You can check the math, but I think I come up with $43.19. You know, can you imagine how impressed your people are? He's got a target price, second decimal point nailed down. All you've done is taken the cost of equity. Now think about what happens when you buy a stock that's undervalued. I go out and buy the stock, and I believe, for instance, that, the 42.30 was my value per share. So the expected value is based on my value per share. If I go out and buy the stock today at 40.76, which is the price today, if my valuation is right, that price should go up to $43.19 a year from now. That'll be a price appreciation of, I think, 5, 6, 7%. You add the dividend on top, my total return on this company will be 11.89%, well above the 7.7%. So let me review again, since I screwed up the starting point. I take my value per share. I apply the cost of equity to it to get the expected value 1 year from now. Subtract out the dividend, that gives me my expected price a year from now. And since I know the price today, I can tell you this is how much the price appreciation will be over the next year. So if you do a DCF valuation per share for your company and I ask you, what will the target price be 1 year from now? You now have the mechanism. What if I ask you, what's the target price going to be 5 years from now? Since many sell-side equity research analysts have a five-year target price. All you have to do is what I did for 1 year, take the 7.7% and do a compounded return over the next 5 years. You still have to subtract out the dividend, but you'll be able to give me a target price 2 years from now, 3 years from now, 4 years. You can actually develop the entire DCF and give me target prices per share based on your valuation if that's what somebody wants rather than the value per share today. Any questions on getting target prices and how the dividends play out? So the cost of equity is your expected return in total. You subtract out the dividends, that's your expected price appreciation per share. That can be used to get target prices based on your value per share today. So let's go back, let's continue on this discussion by moving to the second topic. Con Ed was easy, right? Regulated utility. I'm gonna stay with my training wheels on and pick another easy company to add. You're familiar with 3M? I own 3M. You know why I own 3M? Because every Christmas, when it's time to hang up the lights, I go to the hardware store and I said, this company is ripping me off. Because you bought those hooks, the 3M hooks that you put up with. Can you imagine what the margins must be on those damn things? You pay like $6 per plastic hook with a little piece of stuff on the back. I mean, these must make like 95% margins. My reaction whenever somebody's ripping me off is I buy shares in the company, so I'm partly ripping myself off, kind of an offsetting effect. So 3M is actually a company which makes a lot of money. It's been around a long time. Nice, stable, money-making company with a lot of history. Whenever you have a nice, stable, money-making company with a lot of history, evaluation becomes more straightforward, right? You can draw on financials, you can look at the ratios. So this is the valuation I did on September 12th of 2008. File that date away. Because if you remember that equity risk premium crisis thing that I did, September 12th was the Friday before the 2008 crisis. I would love to tell you that Friday, I was looking across the weekend and said, a crisis is coming. Absolutely no idea. I was completely oblivious to it. So this is a valuation of a mature company in what I thought was a nice mature market where crazy things don't happen overnight. So I'll go through the process. I took the existing numbers. So If you look at the existing numbers, they're making about, they're reinvesting about 30% with a return on capital of 25%. Hallmarks of a good company, right? Earning well above the cost of capital, not reinvesting much, but that's what you'd expect from a mature company. If you take that reinvestment times return on capital, you get a growth rate of about 7.5%. So I basically took the earnings now, projected them to grow at 7.5%. At the end of year five, I made them a mature company and gave them a growth rate of 3%, lower than my risk rating. Kind of checking all the boxes. This is a valuation where you don't need much of a story, though I'm implicitly telling you a story. What's the story I'm telling? This is a company that's going to continue to do what it's doing now. It's going to be able to keep making money the way it is right now. With that mature company story and applying a cost of capital of 7.88%, the value per share that I got by discounting the cash flows back, adding cash, subtracting debt, was $83.55. The stock was actually trading at 70. It was like Friday at 3:15. And I said, I should buy the stock, but I said, I'll do it on Monday. What can happen over a weekend? Thank God I waited. Some of my best investment decisions have come because I was too lazy to act quickly. Because on Monday, of course, you woke up to a market crisis. The reason I'm going to start with this is there's this canard about valuation that if you do an intrinsic value of a company, it's somehow timeless. Because what can happen to intrinsic value? Especially if it's a mature company. I'm going to argue that that's not true because if the world changes around you, guess what? Your intrinsic value has to change as well. So what I'd like to do is take 3M about 4 weeks into the crisis. By then we realized the world had melted down and ask what would the value be if nothing about the company, there were no earnings reports that had come out about the company. If nothing about the company changes, what might happen to the value per share? So here's what I did. This was 4 weeks later, same numbers, right? Same earnings reports. But here's the way the value changed. First, when you're in a crisis, remember we talked about the price of risk going up. And in discounted cash flow valuation, this is not an abstraction, right? Because when we talk about the price of risk going up, we're talking about higher default spreads. It's not like 3M's rating dropped, but the default spread they were paying for the same rating was much higher. Why? Because we were in a crisis. And the equity risk premium, the implied premium, had gone from 4% to 6%. So I changed nothing else in the valuation in terms of the inputs. I did bring in the fact that now that you were in this crisis, there was a potential for a recession that had increased. So I lowered the growth rate because of that. But my point is nothing new had come out about the company, but the macro environment had shifted. And because the macro environment had shifted, the value per share that I got was 61. The stock was trading at 57. When stock prices drop for a company, the first reaction, you know, I call this knee-jerk contrarianism, which is if a stock price drops, it must be cheap. Stock price dropped here, but it's definitely not become cheaper. It's actually become closer to fair value. So I think the market is not adjusted enough, not adjusted too much. So this is in a crisis where nothing about the company changes, but the macro environment has changed. I don't think anybody in this class is valuing a Russian company, but there's somebody in my undergraduate class who's valuing a Russian company. God help them. Now I offered him, you can change to a Ukrainian mining company if you want. He didn't think that was much of a swap. But I gave him a one-time deal. I said, this is going to be really messy. Why? Because first, you can't even get a market price for the company anymore because in most Russian stocks, trading has been suspended since the end of February. And it's not just the macro environment has changed. The company's business model itself is going to be different. So when crises happen, and they often happen, it's not in your control, be ready to revisit evaluation. I'm praying and hoping nothing like that happens before May 8th. Or May 9th, whenever you're pro. But if it does happen, be ready to reassess the way your story for the company and how it plays out in the numbers. So, any questions on this valuation? So, basically, I've adjusted both the cash flows and the denominator, but the real pain is coming from having higher price of risk. I mean, this is one more reason I think it makes far more sense to have an implied equity risk premium rather than sticking with the historical premium, Because if you use a historical premium, everything is going to look cheap in the middle of a crisis, right? Because you're using a 4.5% premium that is a 100-year history. You might be in the middle of the greatest crisis of all time and everything is going to look cheap to you. So we've talked about Con Ed, we've talked about 3M. My third valuation is not going to be of a company, it's going to be of the S&P 500 index. Remember, there's no reason you can't apply intrinsic valuation to an entire index, right? Cash flows, growth, and risk apply to an entire index. And this was a valuation I did in November of 2020. I'm going to remind you what the world looked like in November of 2020. In March of 2020, the market had crashed, right? We're at the start of COVID, everything had been shut down. November of 2020, everything was still shut down. There was no vaccine yet. This was pre-vaccine. But the market had gone back all the way, not just to where it was on February 14th before the crisis, but it was about, no, it was actually higher than it was. And the reaction people had was the market's gone crazy. And they used two pieces of evidence to show that the market was crazy. First, they said there's a disconnect between what's happening in the economy and what's happening in the market. And you can see the disconnect, right? People still didn't have jobs. The unemployment rate was still in double digits. The economy was in shambles. Say, how can the market be going up if the economy is doing this bad? So that's the first question. The second was, even if you assume that there was light at the end of the tunnel, you said, should it be going up this much? Won't there be permanent damage left over because of COVID? That'd be large enough that it should be 25% lower than we were before. So I decided to take those questions first and deal with them head on. Let's start with the question of, how can a market be going up and the economy is kind of doing badly or even in a recession? So to answer that question, I looked at the data. What I mean by looking at the data is I looked at every quarter, how much the S&P 500 went up, and I have the data going back in time. And every quarter, what the real GDP change was in that quarter. What that measures is what the, because it's the purest measure of economic growth that I can think of. Nominal, you can have inflation play out. So when real GDP growth goes up, it means the economy is strong. So I had, I don't know how many quarters from 1960 to 2020, 240 quarters of changes in the index, changes in real. So this graph, basically the first thing that you notice is the economy is a lot less volatile than markets are, which is understandable. Then I drew on statistics. I said, is there a link between how the economy is doing and how the market does contemporaneously? You know what I mean by the same quarter. Take a look at the correlation, minus 0.06. What does that tell you? That in the same quarter, there's actually a slightly negative correlation, close to zero, between what the market does and what the economy is doing. If the economy starts to slow down, you're going to listen on CBS, economy slowing down, market should come down. That is not the way history has worked out. The link between what happened to the economy and what happened to the market in the same period is close to zero. However, I also looked at what happened to market and what the GDP does next one quarter ahead, two quarters ahead. And notice what happens, the correlation is I look at what the market does this quarter and what the GDP does next quarter, two quarters ahead, three quarters ahead. The correlation turns positive. It peaks around 26%, 0.26. What does that tell me? If there's any lesson, if there's a lesson in history, the market is a predictor of what the economy will do three or four quarters ahead. It's definitely not a perfect predictor. I wouldn't take it to the bank and start to try to make money on it. But what the market was doing in November of 2020 was it's trying to forecast what will the middle of 2021 look like. And it was seeing a much rosier picture than most experts were. Now, one of the lessons I learned from COVID was to trust experts less and trust the markets more. And nobody remember all through 2020, what did people tell us about vaccines? The experts, the pandemic experts. Vaccines can't be developed in 9 months. It'll take at least 2 or 3 years. And markets said, no, we'll come up with a vaccine much sooner. Towards the end of 2020, what did the experts say? Oh, we won't be back from this till 20. I remember one guy saying, not till 2025 will we see unemployment below 10%. I don't know where that guy is. But I'm sure he's gone through and selectively erased whatever he said then. He's back on CNBC now. I think an unemployment is going to go to 1%. Markets were doing their job. They're not perfect. Of course, they can screw up. So the first question, I said, you know what? I can understand why markets are up, even though the economy is down, because it's trying to forecast what will happen. Now, is it being over-optimistic? To answer that question, I need to provide a little more specifics. So here's what I see as the picture of an index, right? So if you ask me to value an index, I have the level of the index, right? That's what you're paying, like the stock price. Because these are the 500 largest market cap stocks or whatever's in the index, my cash flows will be the collective cash flows I get from those 500 companies. If I really had a lot of time and patience, I could go through and compute the cash flow for each of the 500 companies, right? A free cash flow to the firm. I'll be quite honest. That exercise, just thinking about it, exhausts me. So I cheated. I said, instead of trying to get the cash flows for each firm, I'm going to look at the collective dividends and buybacks from across all these firms, assuming that in the aggregate, they return what they can afford. So the dividends and buybacks become the cash flows. And of course, those cash flows come from your earnings. So my structure for valuing the index is basically take my expected cash flows for the next 5 years. And then I very quickly have to put this into stable growth because these are the 500 largest market cap companies. If this looks familiar, this is basically what I did to get an implied equity risk premium. But here, instead of solving for the equity risk premium, I'm going to assume an equity risk premium based on what I think we need to make on stocks and see if I can value the index. So remember again, the setup. The setup here was everybody believed the market was vastly overvalued in November of 2020. Based on fundamentals. I wanted to see if that was true. Now, of course, we're looking at 500 companies. And again, I can't sit there projecting earnings for each of the 500 companies. So here are my cheating devices, what I use the implied equity risk premium. I said, let me look at what analysts collectively are projecting as earnings. I know analysts have a bad name of being biased, but these analysts actually do a pretty good job. They're analysts who track the entire index and forecast earnings for the aggregate index. The bias shows up when you look at individual analysts who track individual companies. These are analysts who track the index. So their track record, if you look back in time, is they're wrong, but they cut in both directions. Sometimes they underestimate some. So I started by looking at analysts for projecting as earnings for the index. I'm going to give you the three sources I looked at. One is a guy called Ed Yardeni. He's actually, if you get a chance, you type in Ed. Every week, he actually forecasts aggregate earnings for the S&P 500. For the next 2 years. I don't think I found a reliable source that does more than 2 years, but that's okay for me. I can start with those 2 years. The second is what analysts and consensus are projecting. So these are all the top-down analysts who track the index. There are about 15 or 20 of them. Their collective estimates for the earnings next. So if you look at the numbers, you can see 2020 earnings collapse. So 163 was the earnings in 2019. They're all in agreement that 2020 was going to be terrible. But they were also all in agreement that there would be an improvement back in 2021 and further in 2022. Do you think they undershot or overshot the market? Because we now have the numbers 2021 and 2022. Because they were projecting, I think, 155. Analysts, the consensus, 166.21. I think the actual number came in at 169. That's what I mean about that being, they're wrong, but they can undershoot and overshoot. And these are actually the market strategists at investment banks. And every 6 months or so, Barron's actually puts out a list of what they're projecting as earnings. My point is I'm collecting what people are projecting as earnings, analysts, you know, strategists. Why? Because I don't have the bandwidth to be projecting out earnings for 500 companies and doing this on my own. So that's going to become one of my starting points is what will happen in 2021 and 2022. I'm drawing on the analyst projections as my starting point. For the cash flows, remember, not all earnings will get paid out. I've looked at how much companies return in the form of dividends and buybacks. Now, again, if this had been a normal year, I could take last year's dividends and buybacks and grow them. But this was 2020. People were cutting dividends, you know, reversing themselves on buybacks. So I looked at what percentage of earnings companies have paid out. This is the S&P 500, have paid out in dividends and buybacks. So the way to read this is you take dividends and buybacks, divide by the earnings. In 2001, 77.4% of earnings were paid out in dividends and buybacks. And if you look across time, that median number is about 83%. So across the 20 years, companies, the S&P 500, have returned about 83% of their earnings from dividends and buybacks. So when I make my projections, at least I have a sense of what percentage of earnings do companies typically return back. So I've got my base earnings, I've got an estimate of what gets returned. The final big input is an equity risk premium. Now, in this case, remember, you get to pick what you think is a reasonable premium. Unlike the implied premium, where you take the market's number as a given, I'm going to let you be a market timer. That's the essence of market timing, right? You can make a judgment on what you think is a fair premium. Again, I'll give you some perspective. If you look at implied premiums from 1960 to 2019, the average is about 4.2%. You can say, well, that's what I need. If I look at 2000 to 2019, a riskier period, it's up to 4.86%. If I look at what's happened since the 2008 crisis, that number becomes 5.58%. Which one's the right one? I have no idea. This is your judgment to make. And if you say, look, I need to make at least 5.58%, the value you're going to attach to the index is going to be much lower than if you settle for 4.2%. So I'm going to pull it all together and show you the assumptions I made. This is my valuation of the index, but you can very quickly disagree and make it your valuation of the index by changing the key numbers. So here's what I have. I took the, I used the analyst projections to assume that earnings would drop in 2020 to 130. Remember, we weren't all the way through 130 in November of 2020, so I had to make a judgment of what the base year would look like. I did assume they would bounce back to 166 in 2021 based on that consensus estimate. In terms of cash flows, and I also, and this is key, I did assume in November of 2020 that 80% of that drop, it's transitory. What does that mean? Once COVID passes, which we never, which I didn't know then would be forever, earnings would bounce back. But there were some companies where I thought the damage was permanent. Carnival Cruise Lines, those earnings are never coming back. Airlines, a big chunk of the earnings might be gone forever. For dividends, I did assume that 2020 would be a terrible year, down 20%. That's an awful year for dividends. In 2008, dividends dropped by about 20%. I assumed that 2020 would be like that. But buybacks would be down a lot more. Why? Because buybacks are more flexible. In a bad year, you're more likely to cut them, down 50%. And I assume going forward that companies would be more cautious about returning dividends. Why? Because when you're in a crisis, you learn that you need cash. Cash allows you to survive. And finally, for the risk-free rate, I took the T-bond rate on November 1st, 2020, and an equity risk premium of 5.58%, saying what's happened since 2008 is what I'm going to look at because we're in a crisis. I have everything I need to value the index. Here's what I did. So if you look at what I'm projecting in 2020, big drop-off in earnings and cash. So basically, I'm showing you what my projections were before COVID hit for 2020 versus after. So I'm being realistic. This is going to be a major, it's going to create major damage to earnings and cash flows. I do see recovery over time, but not a full recovery. And I'm discounting these cash flows all back at a required return of 6.446%. That's the risk-free rate plus the equity risk premium. What I get as a present value, 3108, was slightly lower than the index, but not by any amount where I'm going to go around and say market's overvalued. This is actually close enough to fair value that my conclusion in November of 2020 is I'm not going to do any crazy things to the market. I'm going to go buy individual stocks if I find them interesting. But there's nothing here that says red flags going off. I should be getting out of the market entirely. I've redone the S&P 500. The most recent one I put up started this month. If you get a chance, it's no, because of the Russian invasion, I said, I've got to update it. So if you look at my March 1st implied premium, I also did a valuation of the index the next day. So if you get a chance to revisit that, because the numbers are pretty fresh in terms of earnings and cash flows, you don't have to change those, but you can change your equity risk premium. Say, I would ask for a bigger premium. I'm settling for a lower premium now than in November of 2020 because I don't feel as scared, because that's what drives your equity risk premium, a 5% premium. But 5% would be a pretty decent premium. I also have added this feature of letting you change the T-bond rate over time, because you might say the rates are going to go up. I think they're going to go to 3%. But the framework is exactly the same. I'm projecting dividends and buybacks. I'm discounting them back at this cost of equity. What I get as a present value is the value of the index. Now, I did this for the S&P 500. You can do it for any index. the advantage you have with the S&P 500 is I have this luxury of riches, right? Analyst projections of earnings. I have the history because I've been tracking the index for a long time. But if you gave me the Sensex or the Bovespa, there's no reason why I can't value an entire index the way I value an individual company. Any questions on valuing an index? So we get a chance, visit the S&P 500 valuation and see what you get. Now, when I finished this valuation, I think, you know, I don't know where I was, and I was asked about the value, and I said, you know what, I think stocks are fairly close to fairly valued. And the person who asked me the question was surprised. He thought I was going to tell him that stocks are massively overvalued because the fundamental, because that's what he'd been hearing from people who, you know, who believed in market fundamentals. He says, are you sure? And I said, I'm never sure about anything. How can I be sure? I'm valuing the market. We're in the middle of COVID. We have no idea what tomorrow is going to bring to us. How am I going to be sure? So I said, let me show you how uncertain I feel. Because remember the base assumptions here, right? Cash flows would return 80. So basically what I did was I took my big assumptions and I made them distributions. It's called a Monte Carlo simulation. Now, 30 years ago, this would have been impossible for me to do because I needed access to a mainframe and paid somebody $1 million to do it. Today, with crystal ball at your fingertips, you can basically run this on any of your valuations. Don't worry, you don't have to do this on Friday, but if you want to add this layer on to your DCF, finish your valuation as if there's no, and then you can bring in crystal ball. It allows you then to take your base inputs, like that revenue growth number that you're freaking out about. So I don't know whether it'll be 12% or 18%. With crystal ball, I'll let you put in a distribution. It's an amazingly powerful tool. Because what the simulation then does, I think crystal ball's default is 10,000 simulations. So it goes in and picks a number out of each distribution. In fact, it even allows you to build in correlation across your assumptions. If you think that your cash flows return will be higher if earnings are better, which is, I think, a sensible assumption, you can build that correlation across them. So the simulation basically builds in that correlation. The bottom line is when you get the output, you don't get a value of the index, one value in the distribution. So what am I going to do with it? You can still take the median. Think of this as very similar to your base case, but I now have a whole host of additional information, right? The 10th, so I can tell you what the range is, best case, worst case, everything that you do in a traditional spreadsheet by asking what if questions, you can answer much more richly and more realistically by doing a Monte Carlo simulation. So you're going to see me use this whenever I feel uncertain. And I do it because for the same reasons, you know, right now when you feel uncomfortable about evaluation, what makes you uncomfortable that you're making assumptions about the future, that you could be wrong? You know what? Let me take that off your chest. Of course you're going to be wrong. Ask yourself, how wrong can I be? That's what a Monte Carlo simulation allows you to do, is take that uncertainty you feel, make it into a distribution. I call it facing up to uncertainty rather than hiding from it or going to denial. Look it in the face. It's a lot less scary once you look it in the face. So it's a tool, at Stern you have access to crystal ball free. But my suggestion is if you're going to be working with numbers in any kind of job, spend the money to buy crystal ball. It's an Oracle product. It's $700 or something for, you know, it's not a subscription-based product. You can just buy it one time. $700 sounds like a lot of money, but if you think about working with Excel spreadsheets over and over with uncertainty driving your numbers, it's a great way to be able to look it in the face and bring it into your outcomes. Yes?
For the index bubble valuation, how does it change in the constituents over time?
Does everybody get the point? The S&P 500 is not fixed over time. Companies come in, companies leave. At the time that the change happens, there's no effect on the index, because it's basically set up that you replace a company in the index with another company and the proportions get recalculated. So there's not an index change from it. But it can change your forecast, right? Because the S&P 500 takes out the most negative growth companies, the companies in trouble out, and replaces them with successful companies. You know, normally you wouldn't expect the 500 largest market cap companies to ever grow faster than the economy, because they're dying, they're declining. You know, you're picking big companies. The reason the S&P 500 is able to grow for higher than the economy, even for the next 5 years, is because this process keeps reinventing itself, where you it's not a big change because you're replacing two or three companies in a typical year with two or three companies. It's not like you're replacing 250, but it gives enough juice to the index that it can continue to grow a little faster than the economy. Eventually, even that will run out. But basically, I'm valuing the S&P 500 as of now, but the reason I'm giving them growth is at least a portion of the index has been Tesla has replaced some, you know, company that had a minus 30% growth rate. So it does affect it at the margin, but it's not something that makes a huge difference in the valuation itself. You're not valuing the 500 largest companies 5 years from now. You're valuing the 500 largest companies in the index today and making a judgment about it, because that's what you'd get if you bought the index today. Any other questions? So now I want to talk about what I call the dark side of valuation. This isn't a horror movie, but it's actually the title of one of my books. It's actually, and you'll see why I picked it as my title in a few seconds. Whenever you sit down to value a company, you think of Excel spreadsheets, right? But the way I think about any valuation is you're trying to answer four big questions about your company. So I want you to think about your company that you're valuing right now and think about how you answer these questions. The first question I ask you is, how much cash flows are you making as a company on your existing investments? So I'm kind of asking you to be not ambitious, just tell me, what do they own? What do they make right now? How will you answer this question? You pull out the financial statements, you point to their earnings, but remember, that's coming from their existing investments. Think of that as the easiest of the four questions to answer, because you can depend on the current financials to answer. The second question I'm going to ask you, and notice how I'm going to phrase this question, is what is the value that you're going to add or destroy with future growth? Notice I didn't ask you what's your future growth, because you're going to give me a number, right? 30, 50, 80, because the higher the number, the more you think you're helping. But remember, growth is a double-edged sword. The good side of growth is it pushes up your revenues and earnings. The bad side is you got to reinvest money, which means that growth can add value, do nothing for value, destroy value. So in your company, the question I'm asking is, first, is growth adding or destroying value? Which will come from your assumptions about reinvestment and the growth, right? And second, how high can that number be? Which will be a function of, are you a small company in a big market or a big company in a small market? The third question I'm going to ask you is, how risky are your cash flows? Notice what I didn't ask. I didn't ask you, what's your beta? Don't mistake models for big questions. If you choose to use the CAPM to come up with the cost of equity and come up with, of course I'm okay with it. But if you choose to go to that histogram like I did for Uber and say, I'm just going to pick a risky cost of capital, I'm okay with that as well. The one principle that I will not give on is if you say, I don't care about risk, I'm going to use the same discount rate for every company. That makes no sense to me. So I'm going to be, so if I'm agnostic on how you adjust for risk, but adjust for risk in the discount rate. And then when I have the final question I ask is, when will your company become a mature company? Why? Because I need that closure, right? A terminal value. I can't do that until you tell me your growth rate is going to be less than the growth rate of the economy. So I'm going to state the obvious. When those four questions are easy to answer, valuation becomes very straightforward. When those questions are difficult to answer, valuation becomes difficult. Stating the obvious, might as well state. You're saying, when are those questions going to be easy to answer? You take a couple like 3M. What made 3M easy to value? Well, you had long history, you had financial data, business model that's established, you know how they make money. Think about answering those four questions. You have a lot of data, a lot of ammunition. The questions are easy to answer. If the only type of company you value is a company like 3M over and over again, you don't need this class. In fact, you don't need to even do valuation. You can automate the process, right? You can take past year's numbers, take the return on capital, build it in. It's easy to build an automated discounted cash flow model that works for those companies. You think that's great. Let me stick with those companies. First, how do you expect to make money on a company that's easy to value? Because everybody's going to be able to do it. So you really want to value companies where those questions are difficult. I know it makes your life difficult for this semester to have picked a company like that. But as an investor, those are exactly the kinds of companies you want to be able to value, right? Companies where those questions are difficult to answer. So I'll give you some examples. If I ask you to value a young company, every one of those four questions becomes more difficult to answer. And you're going to see why as I start asking those questions. when you have a company that don't fit the accounting mold, you know what I mean? Your biggest capex is R&D. Because you can't just look at the financials and tell me how much this company made, because it's a lie, right? What you see as earnings for a pharmaceutical company or a technology company is really not the earnings. Your biggest capex was subtracted out. And finally, and this is something I think we don't think about often enough in valuation. Valuation becomes difficult if you worry about truncation risk. You know what I mean by truncation risk? Not that your cash flows in year three will be wrong, but there'll be no year three. I want to value the Sberbanks, the Severstals, all those Russian companies. My biggest worry though is I can value them, but I have no idea whether my equity is going to be worth anything, because for all I know, the Russian government might nationalize those companies. I own Alibaba and Tencent. But I own shares in a shell company. Now, in the case of Alibaba in the Cayman Islands, in the case of Tencent, what if tomorrow the Chinese government says those companies are basically entities that will not be recognized? My equity could go to zero. I assume the property is small enough that I can live with it, but that's what I mean by truncation. Companies can go bankrupt, can be nationalized. So we're gonna spend a lot of time looking at difficult to value companies. So I lay out the list of some of the kinds of companies we're gonna look at. And some of you are probably valuing companies on this list. First, we're gonna start with young growth firms. My test is if you can value young companies very early in the life cycle, can probably value pretty much every company because uncertainty is maximized. So I'm going to start there. Second, I'm going to take mature companies, which are usually easy to value, right? But mature companies in transition are changing their business models. Makes it much more difficult to value them, even though you have history, because the company going forward could be more difficult to value than the company going back. And finally, I'm going to talk about the companies that truly depress me while I'm valued, declining companies, potentially going back. You can avoid them, but at the same time, most people avoid them, and they might be opportunities. You know, you might take a bet on, you know, on a brick and mortar retail company. Bed Bath & Beyond might not be a happy, upbeat story, but even with a downbeat story, if you're able to come up with a value higher than the price, you're going to buy the company. So I'm going to talk about companies across the life cycle and how darkness can show up in pretty much every stage. Then I want to talk about companies across markets. A lot of US investors will not invest in emerging market companies for lots of good reasons and lots of bad reasons. One is there are corporate governance issues, cross-holding issues, family group issues. And I agree, they're all concerns, but what if the price is so low that they're incredible bargains, even with those issues built in? So rather than avoid the companies, why not deal with those issues and see if the stock is a bargain? And finally, I want to talk about valuation across sectors. I'm going to talk a little bit about financial service companies, and I'll make an admission. Before 2008, I used to tell people valuing banks is easy. I can never live those statements down. And I'll tell you why I made that statement of valuing banks is easy and why I no longer make that statement. Financial service companies have become nightmares to value. And we'll talk about what it is about them that's made them difficult to value. I want to talk about commodity companies. What makes them difficult to value? Not the company itself, but the commodity. Can you imagine valuing an oil company now versus a year ago versus 2 years ago? Think of how much your valuation shifts over time. How do you deal with the risk of commodity price changes? And finally, I want to talk a little bit about that the companies, pharmaceutical companies, technology companies, where the bulk of the value comes from assets you don't see. In particular, I want to go back to the capitalization of R&D that we did as a small piece, and show you what happens to a pharmaceutical company when you capitalize R&D, as opposed to not. Does the value go up? Does the value go down? You're gonna be surprised, but what can happen when you capitalize R&D, capitalize customer acquisition costs. So let's start with young companies. So let's say you are an entrepreneur, you have a startup, and you want me to value a company. You ready? I'm gonna come to you with my four questions. So you're a very young startup. So here's my first question. What are your cash flows from your existing assets? What's your answer going to be? What existing assets? I don't even own the chair I sit in. That got easy. Okay. Then I ask you, what's your value from future growth? It's a lot. Can you be more specific? Not really, right? You don't have a business model. You don't know whether there's a market out there. Now, how risky are you? I said, very. But beyond that, what can you show me, right? There's no past prices, no past earnings. And then I ask you, when will you be a mature company? You fall out of the chair laughing. You don't even know whether you'll make it through tonight. Now, do you see why most people don't even try to value young companies? Because they say, of course there's too much uncertainty. But it's a feature, not a bug, right? It's not something you can wish away. It is what it is. In fact, things get even worse if you're a young company in a sector where every other company looks just like you. They're all young companies early in the life cycle. And I'll tell you why. When you valued your company, think of the three places you went to get the information to value your company. First, you looked at your company's financials, right? You went through the income statement, the balance sheet, the statement of cash flows. Second, you looked at your company's history, hoping to see patterns, right? Maybe I can get a margin over the last 5 years. What did they look like during a recession? And third, you looked at industry averages. At least you looked at the industry averages I gave you, or you computed your own. You look at a company's financials, you look at its history, you look at its the rest of the sector. One by one, let me knock your crutches out. You're valuing a young company. What did I just take away? You don't have much history. It's a young company early in its life cycle. So what are you going to learn by looking at its financials? Absolutely nothing. That it didn't sell much. It lost a lot of money. And then you look at other companies. They're all like your company. They're all money losing. You with the trifecta. This is when the dark side will beckon. And what does the dark side look like? First, it's dark. It says things like, valuations don't matter for companies like these. It asks you to tell macro stories for the company. Why are you even bothering with the company? Why are you buying Rivian? Because electric cars are going to be huge. And you leave it at that. I still remember, you know, is when Alibaba went public, and I was with the CNBC analyst at the time of the IPO, and I said, "Why are you putting?" He had a valuation like 3 times higher than mine, or pricing. And I said, "You know, why are you putting such a high value?" He said, "Because it's going to be a huge company." And I said, "How huge?" He said, "I don't know, but it's huge." This is what you get away with macro stories. This is the Cathie Wood phenomenon in a capsule, right? You can look at every company in Cathie's portfolio. And I think she's great at macro trend spotting. And you look at what's the story for why she owns Spotify, why she owns Tesla, why she owns DocuSign. There's one common feature. They're all part of a disruption that's going to make the market really big. You tell macro stories. You talk about paradigm shifts. What does that mean? You have no idea what's going on. You can't explain it. You call it a paradigm shift. And you create metrics that nobody's seen before. Like what? You take the market cap and divide by number of subscribers. If you think about the sector that I just described, young companies, all young companies in the same sector, all losing money, all with small revenues. That was the dot-com sector in a capsule in the 1990s, right? It's now the EV sector with one big giant in Tesla. It will probably the cloud business if you don't count the big players. Like there are businesses like this that get created over and over again. And you see this happening in these sectors where people give up on traditional metrics. Why? Because their traditional metrics are all based on earnings and book value. It's not working. So they divide the price by something. And I remember the late 90s, I would do these valuation seminars, the peak of the dot-com boom. At the end of the seminar, somebody would come up to me and say, "You really can't value Amazon.com using a discounted cash flow model, can you?" Very aggressively, the finger going like this, "Please step back, you're gonna hurt me." The risk of grave personal injury, I say, "Yes, you can." And they give me this look of total contempt. And the way they said academic was not meant as a compliment. It basically meant, "You really can't do it, you're just talking about it." And after about the fifth or sixth time of being called an academic, I got really pissed off. I remember the day, it was like 1997, like August something. I said, "You know what? I'm going to do a discounted cash flow valuation of Amazon. It's actually still on my website, the first valuation I did of Amazon. And I'll be quite honest, the first time I valued Amazon, it's like pulling teeth every single step of the way. I had to come up with great, there was nothing in the literature about how to value young companies. I mean, they gave things like use the sustainable growth model. To do what? Return on capital times reinvestment rate for a young company, which is money losing with tiny revenues. How is that going to help? So I actually kept a journal as I was valuing Amazon. And by the time I was done with the valuation, the journal was 75 pages long. Shows you how many barriers I ran into and how many creative solutions I had to make up. I never waste anything I write. So at the end of my valuation, I pulled out the journal, 75 pages long. I gave it a title, The Dark Side of Valuation, Can Amazon.com Be Bad? It's still on my website somewhere. And that became the basis for that Dark Side of Valuation book, which was about dot-com companies collectively. That was in 2001. I thought that the dark side beckoned only with these young companies. In 2009, when I did my second edition, I realized the dark side was everywhere because anytime people feel uncertainty, they go to the dark side. 2009, people had given up on valuing banks. They had no idea what the regulatory frame. People give up all the time. People give up on valuing oil companies and oil prices get volatile. So I'm going to argue you got to fight through that uncertainty. So I'm going to take you back through January of 2001 and show you my Amazon valuation. January of 2000. Now, what I want you to do, and this is going to be really, there's a reason I don't do case studies in class, because you know what actually happened. It's very difficult to keep that hindsight bias from coming in. You all know what Amazon looks like now. So this was January 2000. I want as best as you can to put yourself in that point in time. So let me set the table. January 2000, you're the peak of the dot-com boom. The NASDAQ had just hit 5,000 for the first time in history. Amazon.com was the poster child for the dot-com sector. It's the star of the show. It's actually, I think with AIMR, which is the parent organization for the CFA, came to me and said, can you do a session? And they were going to record it with a cameraman on how to value Amazon.com, because our listeners are very interested in how you value these young dot-com companies. I should say, sure. So I'm going to, in fact, that webcast might be on the AMR website as well. I don't know how long they keep, but I'm going to give you a compressed version of that webcast. So let me set the table. You're at the peak of the dot-com boom. Amazon had revenues of 1.1 billion. Let me pause there. A US retail firm, that's what Amazon was, with a billion in revenues is a tiny firm. Just to give you a perspective. Walmart in 2000 had revenues of 200 billion. Today it's like 400 something billion, 200 billion. Costco was 30 gig. I mean, you could go through. Gap was 20 billion. Amazon was a tiny company in terms of revenues. It was losing $410 million. Basically, it's a company with small revenues, which is losing a lot of money. Again, not by itself the end of the show, because that's what you'd expect young companies to do. So I'm going to start with a very simplistic question. Can a company with small revenues and big losses become a valuable company? It's an easy one. Sure, right? Every company at some point in time is a young money-losing company. So then let me ask you the follow-up question. And again, let's stay simplistic. For a company with small revenues and big operating losses to become valuable, first, what's got to happen to the small revenues? What has to happen to them over time? They have to become big revenues, right? And I said, we're going to be simplistic. What has to happen to the losses? They've got to become profit. They can't just be smaller. So basically, my first two big assumptions when I valued Amazon in January 2000 were revenue growth, because that brought my small revenues to big revenues, and a target margin. If you look at my FCFF simple Ginzu spreadsheet today, you see the seeds of that spreadsheet being, because January 2000, I was building this from scratch. I said, I need revenue growth to get my small revenues to big revenues. And I need my margins to go from negative to positive. And I need, so I'll give you the numbers I use for Amazon. My revenue growth, I projected a compounded annual revenue growth rate of 42% a year for the next 10 years. Let me repeat that again. A compounded revenue growth rate of 42% a year for the next 10 years. Remember, I said this was a webcast. people were watching and sending in email questions. I still remember right after I said 42% compounded for the next 10 years, I get the first question. How come you're being so pessimistic about future growth? I said, I'm making $1 billion in revenues into 40 billion in 10 years. That's a 40-fold increase in revenues. You're accusing me of being pessimistic? You know why it sounded pessimistic though? What were they doing? They were comparing the 42% to what the revenue growth was in the most recent year, which for Amazon was 200%. So why? What they missed was the compounded over 10 years, because I was actually not dropping it to 42% right away. I started with 150%, but as the company got bigger, I had to bring those numbers down because scaling up gets more and more difficult to do. Now we'll talk about why I picked 42, why not 45 or 40 or 35, because it clearly makes a difference. But that's my first big assumption. And what does it accomplish? It makes companies' small revenues become big revenues. Half my mission accomplished, right? I turn to the other half. They're right now losing money. They're losing a ton of money, minus 36.7%. Let's start with the easy question. If I expect that margin to stay minus 36.7% forever, how much is Amazon worth? Nothing. It's a question of when you go bankrupt. So in my story, I have to have something that makes me believe the margins will improve. So over time, I assumed that the margins would approach, pre-tax operating margin would approach 10%. See, where do you get the 10%? I looked at, on average, what retailers, brick and mortar retailers, collectively were making as margins. You think, why don't you look at dot-com retailers? Because they were all losing money. Again, I put out the 10%, I get an email question. How come you're being so pessimistic about future margins? The basis for the story was, right? Brick and mortar retailers have all these costs. You're an online retailer, you shouldn't have those costs. You should have higher margins, therefore. And that story never made sense to me. Here's why. Let's say in steady state, online retailers make 15% margins and brick and mortar retailers make 10% margins. If you're a brick and mortar retailer, what are you gonna do? You're gonna shut your stores down, you're gonna go online. You cannot have a business with two different ways of delivering it in steady state where the margins are wildly different because the lower margin business will disappear. So I said that and they said, why won't they converge to 15% rather than 10%? So because that's not the way the world works. Think of what online retailing did to us as consumers. 30 years ago, if you wanted to buy a printer, you know what you did? You got in your car, you drove to the closest, the Wiz might've been the store, or whatever the store was. You drove in, you walked in the store, said, can you take me to the printer section? Salesperson came in, he pointed a printer and said, this is the cheapest printer you could get. You know what I'm checking, right? Of course, you can jump in your car, drive somewhere else, but who has the time for that? I think 3 years ago, if you remember, Best Buy had to start covering those codes on the sides of printers because what it discovered was people walking with their smartphones, scanning and checking out right while they were there. So when the salesman said, this is a low, no, I can see it for lower prices within 2 miles of here. And on Amazon, it's $10 cheaper. What I'm saying is once you have two ways of delivering a business, you increase the power of consumers. So I said, look, if online retailing now becomes part of retailing, what that's going to do to margins, it's going to actually push margins down from 10%, not push them up, because that's what you'd expect to happen. So I'm being optimistic, assuming that margins will converge at 10%. So I've got revenue growth, so that allows my small revenues to become big revenues. As my margins move from minus 36 to plus 10, my losses become profits. I'm almost there. There's one final loose end. To make my revenues go from $1 billion to 41 billion, Amazon will have to reinvest, right? The first time I did this valuation, I did it the way I've always valued companies. I had depreciation, subtract CapEx, subtract change in working capital. And I very quickly realized it wasn't going to get me anywhere. Why? I have no idea how Amazon is going to have to spend money to grow. Forget about I. Jeff Bezos in 2000 probably had no idea to have to do acquisitions, to have invest in R&D. But this much I know, to grow, you have to reinvest. So I said, why am I breaking it out into five different line items? What matters to me is how much they will need to reinvest. So that's when I started consolidating reinvestment in numbers, especially for young growth companies, because I don't have the perspective to tell you where the reinvestment is going to come from. And that's where I got stuck on this valuation for the longest time, for like 4 days, and figure out how to come up with reinvestment. I took last year's CapEx, depreciation, working capital. I very quickly realized that wasn't telling me much. I tried the sustainable growth model, return on, no, that didn't work either. So I said, what's the one number that always is positive and it's driving everything else about the business, and it's revenues. I said, I have to tie how much I reinvest to revenues. It's a long-winded story, but basically that's where the sales to capital ratio that you see in the spreadsheet was born. I said, that's the one number that when this company thinks about growing, think about revenues, and I can now hold them accountable. When they want higher growth, I can say, this is how much you need to reinvest. The sales to capital ratio I used for Amazon was 3. Where did that come from? Looking collectively at the retail business. Notice with 3M, how much I stayed with the company's numbers. Notice with Amazon, how much I'm having to draw on the industry and what everybody. That's the nature of the process. You've got to go outside your company because there's very little in your company you can base it on. So here's how it works. The sales to capital ratio, and if you're wondering in your spreadsheet how I compute reinvestment, I'm going to give away the secret. I take the change in revenues, 1.1 to 2.8 billion. That's about 1.6 billion in additional revenues. I divide by 3, I get the reinvestment. So each year I take the change in revenues, divide by 3, I got the reinvestment. It's a very simplistic process, but the higher my sales to capital ratio, the less I need to reinvest. So if you think your company can grow efficiently, raise the sales to capital ratio. If you think it's growing inefficiently, lower. So I've got my revenues based on the revenue growth rate, my margins based on the target margin, my sales to capital ratio gives me my reinvestment. You net the reinvestment out. And in my optimistic story, and you're going to see why I emphasize the word optimistic, my free cash flow to the firm in year one is minus 931 million. What am I assuming Amazon's going to be able to do in year one? Implicitly, that they can go out and raise 931 million. Year two, a billion. In fact, they have negative. This isn't my upbeat optimistic story. I have negative cash flows for the next 6 years. Why are they so negative? Because I'm so upbeat about, this is one of the strange things. The more upbeat and ambitious you get about your company, the more negative your cash flows are going to be, because I now have to come up with those higher revenues. I am making an assumption. And in January 2000, I didn't even think twice about making this assumption. I'm making the assumption that markets will stay open and accessible. You see why that's a critical assumption here? Because even if I'm right on every single number, if at the end of year one, markets have shut down, I'm not able to raise equity, I'm not able to raise debt, guess what's going to happen to Amazon? You're not going to get to Nirvana. Nirvana is a terminal value. When you value young companies, you're very dependent on capital markets staying open. So when you value these young money-losing companies, especially if you're worried about crises shutting markets down, that's the way you're going to find it. Is many of these companies will not be able to raise. It doesn't mean they're going to go bankrupt. They might be acquired by somebody else with deeper pockets. And that in a strange way means that if there's a crisis, you know who's going to benefit the most? The Facebooks, the Amazons, the Googles, because they have lots of capital and you're in trouble as a young company with lots of potential. They're going to buy you at a bargain price because where are you going to go? So I've got my cash flows. Now to discount these cash flows, I need costs of capital. Keyword is costs of capital, plural. And here's why. When I start this valuation, what does Amazon look like? A young money losing company, right? Very risky. So when I started the valuation, I gave them the beta of dot-com retail, beta 1.6, a cost of capital at that time, 12.84%. I'm being consistent, risky company, high cost of capital. But as I go through time, what am I doing to Amazon? I'm making it a bigger money-making company. By the time I get to year five, I have revenues of 19 billion. It's no longer a tiny company. With operating income of one, I've made Amazon, at least my spreadsheet, a larger, more profitable company. It's cost of capital. Can't be at 12.84% anymore. So you'll notice that as I get further and further into the spreadsheet, the cost of capital declines. And by the time I get to year 10, when it's a large money-making company, the cost of capital is 9.61%. If you're wondering why it's so high relative to the cost of capital you've been using, take a look at what the T-bond rate was then. That's a US T-bond rate. It's not some other currency. It was 6.5%, a different time. in markets, which is one reason I've let the growth rate be 6% forever. I could never get away with a 6% growth rate in today's market in US dollars. But in 2000, I was okay with it because the risk-free rate was so high. So I'm all set. I've got my cash flows. I've cost the capital. I discount the cash flows back today. What I get is the present value of my cash flows is $15.2 billion. Little bit of a one note of caution is if you're setting up a spreadsheet on your own, your cost of capital are changing over time, you cannot use the present value function in Excel anymore. And the reason is very simple. When you have a changing cost of capital, you've got to discount it what's called the compounded cost of capital, which means your cost of capital goes from 12 to 11 to 10. To discount your year three cash flows, you divide by 1.12 times 1.11 times 1.10. And it'll make a big difference. So don't think of it as a minor issue, which is one reason if you look at my spreadsheet, there's a compounded cost of capital. Yes. To start is the brick and online retail. But if you look at the beta that I'm converging on, so I started 1.6, but I converge on 1. So that's a regular retail beta. So initially I'm saying when I think about Amazon, I think online and I think retail, but as the company gets bigger, it's a retail company that happens to be online. So whenever you have a business that's evolving early on, you can treat them as a young company, big fixed costs, lots of operating leverage, but as they mature, you're pushing towards industrial. So there's my present value, add cash. So it shows you how confident they felt about their capacity to raise cash. They'd run the cash close to zero. Subtract out debt, I get a value for the equity. Now remember when we talked about equity options, you probably said, why are we wasting our time? This is like penny change. Take a look at how much of Amazon's equity is eaten up by equity options. This is what happens when companies just dish out options as if they're free currency. $2.89 billion. I subtracted that out, divided by the number of shares outstanding. And remember, because I've already built in negative cash flows, I don't adjust for future dilution. Since I've already subtracted out the option value, I don't have to bring that in. The value per share that I got with my story, and I have to emphasize, it's my story, it could very well be wrong, was $35 per share. January 2000, I felt I was being very optimistic, very upbeat in the story. The reason I emphasize that, stock was at 84. And when you value companies, you're always one question away or two questions away from being exposed as a fraud. You see valuation of a company, what's the first question you ask? What's the market price, right? If the value is higher than the price, the second question you ask is, are you buying? And if I say no, what am I telling you about my own valuation? Nice exercise in number crunching, but I don't trust it enough to act. Half my portfolio is composed of companies I've kind of been trapped into buying because I found them undervalued. So what are you going to do today? So ask me the analogous question here. Obviously, you're not asking me whether I'm buying. What's the analogous question with Amazon? Value's 35, stocks at 84. What would you ask me for January 2000? Am I shorting? And I still remember that was the last question I was asked in the CFA webcast. And I said, not in this lifetime. They said, don't you feel enough? I said, I feel more confidence that Amazon is overvalued than I have in most of the companies were undervalued that I bought. And I said, why aren't you selling short? Why am I more willing to go long when I find something undervalued and go short when something is overvalued? What's the difference? Because all it is a change in sign, right? The first one, you get the negative out first and the positive later. What's the difference?
Best case scenario, stock falls zero.
So, you know what? I'll take that. That's still a big profit, right? If that were the only thing, I'd be selling short a lot more. Price is always determined by other investors, even when it's cheap, right? But let's keep going. How long can I wait when I buy something because it's cheap? Hey, remember, I'm not a portfolio manager. I don't explain to a client. When I buy something and I can wait as long until my spouse finds out that I bought it and makes me sell it. And if she never finds out, I could hold and hold. My time horizon is in my control when I buy something. When you short something, what's your time horizon? What happens when you sell short? You're borrowing somebody else's shares and selling them, right?
Yeah. There's like an adage that the market could be a bit longer than the space holder.
In this case, it doesn't even have to be that long, right? So if you're selling short and you know what the essence of a squeeze is, right? You thought you had 2 years, and all of a sudden, 2 months later, you get this call from your broker saying, we need the shares back. Your time horizon is less under your control when you sell short. And that makes it much more difficult because remember with intrinsic valuation, what do we say? You got to have a long time horizon. You got to be willing to wait for the market to correct its mistakes. I don't have that on my side. It's one of the great asymmetries in investing, right? If you think there's a bubble in markets, you can buy and hold. If you think there's a bubble on the wrong side, you know, sorry, if you think something is massively undervalued, you can buy and hold. But if something gets massively overvalued, so what do I do? I'm not sure. If you think Bitcoin is overvalued or the boring monkey is overvalued or whatever you think is over, what are you going to do? I'm not clear sure about what you do when something is overvalued. Doesn't mean I've never sold short. When I sell short, it's usually in very liquid stocks where I don't have to. I mean, I would never sell short on a GameStop or an AMC. And this is even before, because you have these stocks with tiny floats, and all you need is something happening that can cause your time horizon to cut short. So if you find an overvalued company, I'm going to make you say sell, but I fully understand that you will not sell short because you don't feel the comfort of having your time horizon. So here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to take that Amazon valuation and start extracting some lessons from it that I've used ever since that 2000 or 1997 valuation. The first was, don't sweat the small stuff, and the discount rate is really small stuff. If you're valuing a young company and you find yourself spending 50, 60, 70% of your time estimating discount rates, just let them go. I know some of you valuing young companies, one of the emails I've been getting is, I can't come up with the cost of debt because I can't get a synthetic rating because the company's losing money. My response has always been, check how much debt they have. If it's 2-3%, what difference does it make whether they're triple B, double B, single B? Just give them a rating and move on. This isn't going to make or break your valuation. So remember what I said about not trusting regression betas? That goes in spades when you're looking at young companies. Because here's what the regression beta for Amazon looked like, 2.23. But take a look at the standard error in the beta, 0.50. The true beta for Amazon can be anywhere from 1.2 to 3.2. And with young companies, regression betas are going to be incredibly noisy. Second, let me talk a little bit about my two big assumptions, because these are things you're probably struggling with. How do I decide whether to use 20, 30, 40% revenue? When I first valued Amazon, I valued it the traditional way. Traditional way is to work sequentially, right? Do year one first, then do year two, then do year three. And I discovered that I was having real trouble getting past year two or three because, I mean, I was just saying, I have no idea what's going to happen. So it took me a while to get there, but I said, this is crazy. I can't be doing this year by year. To value Amazon, I've got to almost visualize what success will look like for Amazon based on what I know about the company, its management, the business it's in. So here's what I did. I took the 10 largest retailers in 2000. None of them are called Amazon. And you had companies like Walmart and even the Gap, I think was number 7. And then I asked myself a question, will Amazon make it to this list by the time I get to 2010? And I liked Amazon as a company, even 2000. I liked the way Jeff Bezos ran the company. I thought they would succeed. And they said, you know what? I think they're going to break the top 10 list. Then I asked, will they be bigger than Walmart? My answer was no, because in early 2000, Amazon wasn't selling everything under the sun. So in my story, I saw them get big, but not as big as Walmart, but probably much bigger than the Gap, which is just a specialty apparel retail. So after going back and forth, I said, you know what? I'm going to put them number 6 on the list. Number 6 had revenues of about 40 billion. So guess what I did? I targeted that as my end number. You're saying this is very subjective. Guilty as charged. Young company valuations, you're trying to visualize success. What will that look like? So my starting revenues, my ending revenues, right? You're saying, how do you get the middle numbers? These growth rates by year, they look awfully specific. I'll make a confession, I made them up. And if you made a big deal about any of those numbers, I'll concede them to you. So if you came and said, I think year one growth is going to be 163.35%. So you can take that. You want year two? You can take that as well. If you let me control the starting and the ending points of this valuation, I control the valuation. That's why I said, when you do the growth rate, don't focus on the rate. Look at the end revenues. You're telling a story about end revenues. That's what's driving your valuation. Last thing for today, take a look at the margins. Minus 36.7 to plus 10. What I'd like you to do is take a look at those numbers. Again, they look awfully specific. Looks like I have some crystal ball. But I've used a very simple algorithm to get my margins from where they are to where to that 10%. I'd like you to figure out what that algorithm is. Now, how am I getting minus 13.35 and minus 1.68? I'll tell you, it was not something sophisticated math, but it was based on a game I used to play when I was a kid, where you'd have a starting point and ending point, then you play the game half the distance, and then you do half. I just basically took the distance each year from my end, and I would be saying, why half? Why not? In fact, when I build spreadsheets, I build them in a way that if you disagree with me, you can change it. So if you, the half puts you, brings you to your target very quickly. But if your story has a much more rocky path to margins, you know what you should use? Use a quarter of the distance. What will that do? You'll have the same starting point and the ending point, but you will lose money for a longer period. This is in the current spreadsheet rather than use that I've actually said, when will you get to target? Will it be near 5 years? So that's your mechanism for adjusting the speed with which you move towards health. So small revenues become big revenues, losses become profits. When we come back on Wednesday, I'll complete the Amazon story and you're going to see it play out as a full valuation.